this is take number two on the morning of June 29th, and we start question. Dave, you've got to start question. Dave, you've got a question.
Next question that you had brought up from time to time, the many inaccuracies that have been allowed to seep into our history books because the historians who had written them based most of their work on material printed in the newspapers at the time and other unreliable sources. And there was very little original material on which to base their findings or conclusions. How do you propose to go about correcting some of the distortions that you know exist?
Well, the best way in the world to correct those distortions is to see to it that the presidential papers are accessible for investigation and confirmation of things that happened. You take the trouble with the whole situation has been that presidential papers have been considered the property of the presidents. They have taken them home with them, and a great many of them have been scattered, And the only way you can find out exactly what the president was up to and what he was doing is to have access to those papers and have them properly indexed and microfilmed so you can find out exactly what's going on. Now, there's a tremendous pileup, and they can be used only in on occasion of in investigation of certain instances in the administrations of these presidents. And if we can get that done, then we've got a start on it. Those papers will be accessible to historians so we can get the facts from the president's viewpoint. Most of the so-called facts were written on what somebody thought or what some congressman said on the floor of the Senate or the House or what some newspaper said about what the president was doing and what he proposed to do. I know from experience that most of these things are very, very inaccurate. It took a long time to get access to the real history of Washington as the first president of the United States, one of the most abused men that ever was in the House. And so if we can get those things all lined up, and in the meantime, with what we're trying to do, on what we know and what we have access to, just inspire the youngsters to look at each one of these presidents, we'll have a most interesting story for the
history. In light of your own experience as a president, you have earned some kind of a right to mark the paper of your predecessors as your successors will have a right to mark the paper of your own administration. You feel that you could set that council of directors and appraise your predecessor of each of your predecessors, not only in terms of their achievements, but in terms of their...
I'm very anxious to get the two syllables of these judgment available to these youngsters in a very short, brief manner so that they can understand what it means to be the responsible executive of a great republic.
This is very necessary because there have been glorifications and deifications of some of our presidents, and the job of humanizing the presidents has been left pretty much undone, has it not?
That's right. A great many of them have had biographies who've been very careful to give us an idea of exactly what sort of a man the president was and how he turned out as the chief executive of the nation. And in a great many instances, though, they've been misrepresented both ways. They've been slandered, and they've been built up in some cases too high to which they had no business to be built.
Well, Mr. President, Dave uses the expression mark the paper, that isn't actually what you want to do as far as they're concerned. What you want to do is your own personal, what you want to do is your own of them. Which isn't necessarily a judgment, but your reflection.
Well, I guess it's an opinion. Let's put it this way. Of what each one did under the circumstances under which he had to work.
Based upon the judgment that you've acquired. Get at the truth, to get at the facts.
And not make any statements that are not based absolutely on the facts as we know.
But there is an important area in which as a nation always been right. We hadn't always been correct and been action.
That's true.
And that area has been left pretty much out. For instance, we have heard you define the Indian problem in terms of our past history. And wouldn't you like to bring into full light some of the things you talked about in your lectures?
Oh, yes. I would like very much to give the youngsters some idea of what went on in the formative stage of the Republic. Which finally turned out to be the greatest free country in the history of the world. And in order to do that, we'll have to also outline some of the things that were done that were not morally correct, particularly with regard to the Indian inhabitants of this country.
And in what other sphere, Mr. President?
Well, in
wasting
the,
of resources.
The wasting of national resources, which was which promotion scheme on the part of these people who are always people who exploit the welfare of the country for their own welfare benefit. That was given its greatest joke, in the time of Theodore Roosevelt, who was a very great president in regard to the salvation of the natural resources of the country for the welfare and benefit of the people themselves. We've had it in other administrations, and when we come to each one individually, we try to discuss what each one of those presidents, the attitude of each one of those presidents to the welfare of the nation as a whole, and with regard to the special interests who were trying to exploit the ordinary common man for their own welfare and benefit. And that goes on all the time, still goes on all the time.
President, you also frequently remarked the importance of understanding American history against the background of the world, and bearing now in mind that they're part of a world, and many of the things that the United States does are really result from action in the world.
That's true, in the world as a whole. It took us a long time to find out that we were a part of the international program. In fact, I think the first joke that we had was in the Cleveland administration, in the Venezuela affair on the boundary. And then we had several other instances where it was necessary to assert the fact that we were interested in world affairs. That was in the time of James Monroe, when he made the statement while situation was developing in Europe after the Vienna affair, in which they had intended to come and exploit the Western Hemisphere as they thought they could do. They thought they had, and as they were doing in China, they were doing in a war between the states. If you remember, French states would go and set up a train in America. And as soon as that affair was set, that had broken up in Mexico became the Republic of the Western Hemisphere. And we've always tried as far as we can to be of be help and assistance to our neighbors. In fact, I think there's no place in the world that is fair and has treated fair as well as we have to say that sometimes we have to, sometimes we didn't treat our own inhabitants as well as we should, but that we're learning.
You have always indicated in your lectures that a knowledge of our past and our present is particularly important in these times when we are being challenged by a government from a very powerful source, and that we have taken on it, and that we so that you not only need to bring me to today in the upstory development, but you also have a problem of projecting that a little bit against a future course that we might take. Do you intend to be
We'll try to. We take Charles the First, King Louis, the Emperor William the First, or William is no difference. They're at it.
Doesn't
have to be put into effect by the dictatorships of China and Russia. It's exactly along the same line, but that can most likely be remedied by the people themselves, because the people of France and Great Britain and Western Europe did that remedy on their own basis. When Spain was the greatest power, Charles the Tower, the Holy Roman Emperor, everybody thought that that would wind things up. They had to control the whole of South America and Mexico and the western part of the United States. But the people themselves remedied that, and I think that'll come about. We could manage, we could rather educate the people underneath these dictatorships and dictatorships to know what it means to have a government where the people have the final say and often the final in the government. That's what we're trying to implement, I think.
Well, the Declaration of Independence was a pretty challenging call to, it has been a challenge to refer to everywhere. The people at this stage, do you think at this stage of our development, we ought to constantly stress what is in the
Yes, I think we ought. It originated in Leviticus. If you read the inscription on the Liberty Bell, you find out where the first idea of liberty to all the world came about. It came about in times after the time of Hammurabi and the Egyptian Empire. People then were beginning to awake to the fact that they had some reason to want to know how the government was run by the dictators. Same thing will take place in Russia and China, I'm sure, as time goes on. Because they're in a stage which is, I'd say, 3,000 or 4,000 years behind where we are now on this side of the Iron Curtain.
We have the advent of science and the enormous strides in transportation and communications. And in that sense, history is being accelerated at an enormous rate.
Tremendous rate, no question about it.
So for that reason, taking the Monroe Doctrine as it's been taken from a great many of our youngsters, merely youngsters, now that as they do a great many of the things that are taught them, they're repeated, that are taught them, there is a cube, when in turn something of the sort, it takes a new special meaning these times.
That is exactly right. It takes a whole entirely new special meaning. In the case of Cuba, if they want to make an alliance, if they want to make a challenge, then the same situation needs to be real, needs to be improved.
And we find, in addition to the Declaration of Independence, there's a Constitution, the Bill of Rights. And we notice that when you address youngsters or oldsters, and particularly lawyers and judges, when you talk about the Constitution, they seem to get an enormous reaction and stimulation out of the way you present it. Would you undertake to re-project, reinterpretation of the Constitution and its meaning and its...
Well, the Constitution is written in written language. Simple. It can't say what it thinks exactly what it says. It isn't tangled up with any legal verbiage or any Latin inserts. And when you read it, and you could read it so you can understand it. Now, it was first written, of course. It met the situation at that time, and it had to be amended in several cases, especially with regard to the election of the president. That had to be amended in a manner so it would be practical. The same thing is true of all the rest of the provisions in that Constitution. The more you read it, the more informed you become, and you'll find that the first 10 amendments to the Constitution were those amendments which were insisted upon by Thomas Jefferson and those of the people of that time who believed that the rights of the people should be protected from their government. That's what the 10 amendments were for, to set up a government in the Constitution. In the first three articles, sets up the government of the United States. And the first 10 amendments sets up a protection to the people against that government so they can't be persecuted and unduly prosecuted by that government. That's the idea.
Mr. President, we're coming to the end of the tape. I'll just stand.